Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I am your host, Gary Gramling. I'll be joined by a special guest in just a moment. This week's show, we are going to talk about, I don't want to call them make or break, although we might just end up calling them make or break, but we're going to talk about eight quarterbacks here who they could kind of go either way this season. We're not quite sure what to make of them, those kinds of guys, and we're going to try and figure out I trust by the end of the show, we will have figured out exactly how the 2020 season is going to play out for each of these players, and it will be a failure if anything else were to happen here. And with that in mind, let me bring in our special guest. It is Andy Benoit. Andy, how's it going?
Gary, I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing well. This is going to be a good show. Quarterbacks, always interesting, always a good show. I have no idea what order to put these guys in, and you were in no way helpful. You didn't want to make this list in any way, so we'll just like randomize it. I'll pull a giant lever, and whoever's name comes up, we'll do them first.
Love it. Yeah. No, that's good. It's one less thing to criticize because no one will interpret this as any kind of ranking of any sort.
There you go. All right. Let me build the lever and let me enter the names. And now I am pulling the lever. And Shelby can add a special lever sound. And the first name is Jared Goff. We're going to start with Jared Goff here. That was totally not worth it, that whole intro. But that's okay. We're now on Jared Goff. So Jared Goff, Andy, obviously McVay gets there a couple years ago, has the breakout season. Everyone's pretty excited about it. His fall-off seemed to very much coincide. A lot of people will point to the Super Bowl. I would point more toward the sort of collapse of the offensive line. Had a lot to do with his issues last year. I know he had some issues late in 2018 and in that postseason, but when they were better down the stretch last year, when the offensive line was better, Goff was fine. I mean, he was good. I thought they had a nice finish to the season. So the question is he sort of a cog in this offense? Is he a guy who can sort of give consistently the kind of performances you saw last December when he was once again one of the better statistical quarterbacks in the NFL? Or is he a guy who's just sort of going to ebb and flow with how the supporting cast does around him?
Well, we know he can do it because we've seen him do it. He was in the Super Bowl just a few years ago. Every quarterback is going to be dependent on their supporting cast to some degree. I think in the nature of LA's offense, you could argue that Goff is probably a little more dependent than most quarterbacks would be. When Goff has a clean pocket, he is as good as almost any thrower in the NFL. When he doesn't, he's still a quality player. He still will, most impressively, he'll make the throws knowing he's going to get hit. I mean, he has all the toughness with it. He's not nearly as effective, though. His drop-off in a muddied pocket is a little bit more than a guy like Patrick Mahomes, to use an extreme example. So, and that's partly, Gary, that's also the nature of their system. It's a timing and rhythm passing game. So if the pocket's muddy, it means something happened to the timing and the rhythm. And Goff, as the most important piece in the machine, is still a piece of a machine. So that back to your idea that, yeah, you have to have things around Goff working really well. And I think what's going to be next for him in his development is having a greater sense of mastery in the pre-snap phase. Because the idea that McVay just talking into his helmet and solving all the Rams' problems, it doesn't go that way. That's not how that really works. And Josh McDaniels years ago was talking into Tom Brady's helmet. So we don't need to run with that notion. The quarterback has to own the offense still. And they lost some veteran linemen last season, so Goff assumed more ownership of the offense, and they got better in the second half of the year as he got more comfortable with that.
Yeah, in December, five games in December, when they were scoring right around 30 points per game, I mean, he was 7.6 yards per attempt, 329 yards per game, 11 touchdowns, 4 interceptions. That was an impressive finish to the season. My question to you, Andy, about this offense, and we talked a little bit about this around the draft, is Brandon Cooks is gone, and obviously, you know, he had concussion issues, he had some injury issues while he was there, so he wasn't out on the field every game, but they didn't really address that speed element in this offense. Josh Reynolds will probably have a bigger role here. They drafted Van Jefferson in the second round, who is really more in the mold of the guys they already have in you know, Robert Woods, a Cooper Kupp, but Josh Reynolds, they don't necessarily have that field stretcher here. Does that change what they do offensively? Does it, or you know, is this just a matter of, you know, they have guys who run the routes correctly and the designs are good and they'll figure it out?
Well, you know, I thought that at first. I thought that they lost a speed element with Cooks. I was unaware that at the Senior Bowl, Jefferson, I guess, was the fastest guy at the Senior Bowl in terms of playing speed. Topped out at 21 miles an hour, 20.99 on a punt return drill. That's, I think, you know, obviously these timed races and the 40-yard dashes or whatever it is, they're not going to be truly indicative of football, but the mile per hour that a guy achieves on the field to me is a much better indicator than the 40-yard dash time, because at least on the field he has other people he has to think about and he's wearing his full padding. Okay. So I guess my point is, it's possible, Gary, that the Rams see Jefferson as maybe not Brandon Cooks, who has rare speed, but they probably feel Jefferson can do that role at times. I also know that Cooper Kupp is a little faster than you would guess. He's a long striding speedster, so he doesn't necessarily look as fast, but they feel he's an above average guy with his speed. So between that and Robert Woods, who's not slow, I think they'll be just fine there defensively. What they do to lift the defense, because really the value of speed is how you influence the safety, and how they influence the safety in LA or lift the defense is on their flood concept, where there's one deep route, there's an intermediate route, and there's a shallow route. And the deep route's the one that lifts the safety and opens up the intermediate route. Almost every pass, about, I want to say 80% of passes on flood designs go to that level two route. They really aren't looking at level three as much. There aren't 80% of the plays in the NFL do not feature a guy like a Brandon Cooks, for example. Mm-hmm. So other teams have shown that you can lift the safety without having to have a true top shelf speedster. The Raiders last year did it quite often. They threw it level two a lot, and I think they'd rather do it more now. And obviously they did draft some receivers, but they didn't have any speedster on their offense, and yet their three level stretches or their flood designs were probably the foundation of their passing game, and they were one of the three or four best teams in the league at it with time. So I wouldn't get overly concerned with speed at wide receiver in that system. You certainly need it. I don't know if you need to be, I don't think you need an off the charts speedster on the field though.
All right. That's
you'll take it. You just don't need it.
Yes. No, I hear you. You don't have to yell at me about it, but that's a really interesting take. That's a good way to think about it here. And right now, I want to pull the lever again to see which of the remaining seven quarterbacks will come up. And it is Ben Roethlisberger. So you're not going to like this one, Andy, because we just didn't see a whole lot of Roethlisberger last year. But I was incredibly curious to see how he would perform with no Antonio Brown, without that sort of elite contested catch number one guy in the lineup. And, you know, we saw Juju Smith-Schuster throughout the season. You know, he battled injuries. He struggled for a number of reasons, and we'll see what his future is here. But obviously, it's not as good a receiving core as Roethlisberger had the last time we saw him at full strength, but does he have, I don't know, does he have the kind of approach at this point in his career to maybe do something a little bit differently? And did the fact that the Steelers had to get creative with that offense, does that allow them to add to what they already did with Roethlisberger, get a little more expansive? Or is this just kind of like, well, Roethlisberger's been a guy for so long, we're just going to do what we've always done with him?
Well, what they've always done with him, for the most part, is where he's been at his best and has gotten in the most rhythm is when they spread out and just throw the ball. And Roethlisberger, impressive as it is that he has become a more academic quarterback over the course of his career, which is why he's aged so much better than I ever thought he would. I thought he'd be out by 33, 34, just because of his style of play. He's been better in his 30s in a lot of respects than he was in his 20s. The reason for that is because he's become a smarter QB. He's a more erudite quarterback. Having said that, I think he's still kind of a sandlot player at heart. And when you spread out and it's three receivers to one side, two to the other, you're by yourself as a QB in the backfield. That's a lot of control in the quarterback's hands, and that's where the Steelers' passing game has resided. Now, the challenge with that is it's a lot of isolation routes when you play that way, in part because you're spreading, and in part because if you're by yourself in the backfield, you have no help in pass protection, so you can't afford to have slow-developing routes, and route combinations tend to be a little slower developing. So now we're talking, okay, isolation routes, which means you need talent at wide receiver in order to truly be consistent there. And when they had Antonio Brown, it was tremendous. Juju Smith-Schuster in 2018 with Brown. Smith-Schuster was over 1,400 yards that year, capitalizing on some of the coverages that would really focus on Brown. And then before that, when Le'Veon Bell was part of the mix as well, they've always had two difference-making weapons in the passing game to work with. We don't know if they have that now. They drafted Chase Claypool in the second round, so I would imagine they feel he can be that. He's a rookie who won't have had any offseason, though. James Washington, Deontay Johnson, recent early mid-round picks are coming along, but they're not sure things. So does the offense need to differentiate itself by adding more designs to it? Do they need to help them through the scheme more? And honestly, Gary, I think if that's what they were going to do, they would have done it by now, because it was a hard passing game to watch at times last year.
Yeah, but how much of that falls on the quarterback as opposed to what you can do with sort of an NFL caliber starting quarterback in there? I guess I worry less about what the receivers did last year and more about, you know, what do they look like if you try and run it out there as what they did in 2018 and 2017 and all those years before that.
Well, and I think if that's the case, what they look like is an inconsistent group, because I'm not confident that Washington or Johnson can get himself open snap after snap after snap. Now, you could also make the argument, because those receivers are still a little bit younger and not all the way refined, you could argue that isolation routes might be helpful to them, because it's you get a cleaner picture of the coverage. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows how to beat somebody one-on-one. And that I don't think that's the case, though. I think they need to scheme more for what they're trying to do to help those guys. And their running game needs to be more consistent. And what's interesting, Gary, is their running game and passing game have almost zero overlap. They don't throw a lot of play action, and they don't do a lot of stuff with their passing game out of their run formations. And when they run the ball, there are times that they'll put 22 personnel on the field, two backs, two tight ends, smash mouth football. They'll go to throw the ball in that same game, and they'll put four or even five wide receivers on the field. So not only do the formations not overlap, but even the personnel packages don't overlap. It's almost like there's two Steelers offenses. There's the running offense and the passing offense. And for a lot of years, that has worked for them. I know there are coaches around the league, though, who say, yeah, it works for them because they've had better players than everybody else. Roethlisberger is a unique talent, and we've just talked about Brown and Bell and some of those guys that they've had there. So it's a hard way to play, but I don't think they're going to change the scheme at this point in Roethlisberger's career, especially with no offseason. So now we're talking about asking guys to win one-on-one and asking Roethlisberger to give those guys a better chance because of Roethlisberger's ability to read the field before the snap or extend the play.
All right, let's pull the lever again. Oh, another 2004 draft made of Roethlisberger's. This is J.P. Lossman.
No, wait. I'm sure it is. Yeah, this is Philip Rivers, I'm guessing.
Philip Rivers.
He's the only one
Rivers.
Left.
So, yeah, Rivers, I mean, look, not good last year. A lot of people, including myself, have wondered what would he look like at this juncture in his career if he had better protection, if he had an offensive line that held up in front of him, especially on the interior. he's certainly going to have that in Indianapolis now. I mean, he's got one of the best offensive lines in football. Obviously, they are going to be better in the receiving core than they were in the second half of last year when they just ran out of bodies to play wide receiver. So, I mean, reasonably, can we see a bounce back to maybe not MVP caliber Rivers? I know he didn't win an MVP, but he was sort of in that range for a portion of his career. Or are we kind of like in a, you know, game manager, this team's still going to be based heavily on the run, and you know, Rivers is just going to sort of, you know, get him in the right plays and move it along that way?
Well, let's start with this. Phillip Rivers last season had 30 interception plays. I've studied the interceptions this offseason, Gary, including the dropped the blatantly dropped interceptions. So when you add those up, which to me, that's the same as an interception because the process is the same. The mistakes are the same for the QB. It's just a matter of whether the defensive player catches the ball. When you add up the 30 interception plays from Rivers, he was at fault on, I had him as 19 of them were primarily his fault. 22 of them were, he had some kind of fault in. And there were 24 of them where the pass rush was a negative factor on the play. And that to me is the underlining element of what's wrong with Phillip Rivers in 2019, is that he was not comfortable playing behind a bad offensive line, and his pass rush impacted him. And I know even if you take it off the interception plays, there were some in the Chargers organization, not everyone, but some, who felt like his lack of mobility, which has always been apparent outside the pocket, it has now become apparent inside the pocket, and he no longer moved well within the pocket because he has been a tremendous pocket mover throughout his career. That's part of the reason he's able to get away with a goofy throwing motion and almost no out-of-pocket mobility, is he just can buy himself time and space within the pocket. Some believe that that aptitude is starting to decline. I don't know if we know that for sure, because what happens when you play behind a bad offensive line, and that's what it's been in Los Angeles for the Chargers, is, as we talked about this a few weeks ago, the quarterback knows it's a bad offensive line. It's not just us at home that see it. He's the one down there who has to live in fear of it, and I think it can impact the way you play sometimes. And Rivers is a tough guy, but he's also smart, and he realizes if I'm getting hit, the offense is not functioning well. So what do I do to not get hit? Well, I have to play a little bit differently, and that's probably the subconscious part of it now. He's going to have a great offensive line in Indianapolis. That's what I'm getting at. So I think we'll know this season if Rivers is done or if he can still be a decent high-level QB. His arm's all right. It's not, he's on the decline there, but he's not Drew Brees, where he's really falling off. And Drew Brees, by the way, is still playing like a top-five QB anyway. So the arm's not the issue. It's is he comfortable in the pocket? And he's going to have a chance this season with Indianapolis. I think Indy, besides maybe Dallas, and correct me if I'm forgetting someone, I think Indy has the best offensive line in the NFL.
I think you might be right. I think they might have surpassed the Cowboys at this point. Or the Eagles, or whoever you happen to like up there. Let's pull the lever again here. And we are now going to be talking about Derek Carr. Las Vegas Raiders Derek Carr. So, yeah, I mean, look, we've had this conversation. It's sort of a chicken and the egg type thing with Carr. He does not throw downfield very often. He has not done so in the past couple of years, and I realize people will cite the fact that he has been accurate when he throws downfield, but he does not attempt many of those throws.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you here, but when he does throw downfield, they've been on very defined reads. It's very often it's to a one-on-one matchup. He will throw the deep post if it's a designer deep shot on the post play, but very often he's throwing outside the numbers on fades and balls like that, which, you know, that's fine. I'm just, he's not an aggressive downfield thrower even when he's throwing downfield, though. It's not that style.
I think you did mean to interrupt me, but it's okay, because that was a good point you made.
But
I mean, look, they added Henry Ruggs, fastest player in the draft. They added a whole lot of receivers, actually. They are built to be a bigger play offense here. And the question is, will Carr play that style of football?
That's the question. And you know, players are what they are at some point. It's not like Carr has been surrounded by scabs. He's had a good O-line around him. They've had a decent receiving core there in Oakland, and now into Las Vegas. It's a different receiving core. We will find out for sure what Derek Carr is about. What's his contract situation? I know he was – I'm pulling it up here. He was – near the top when he got the deal, but that was a while, that was a long time ago.
That was ages
so
ago.
So after
now.
This season, what's that?
That was ages ago. I mean, he's,
yeah, that was a long time ago.
He's right around $19 million, which is downright reasonable for a starting quarterback.
Correct. Yeah, and his cap number, and what I was interested in is next year, what's his cap number and what's the dead cap if you want to get rid of him? His cap number next year is $22 million, a little over that. That's very good for a QB. That's two-thirds of what Russell Wilson or guys like that are costing. His dead cap is 2.5. So the Raiders could save $20 million or almost $20 million by moving on from Carr after this season, which means this is a make-or-break year for Derek Carr. And if it does not go well, the Raiders will move on. I would be surprised if so then I'd be surprised if he's here if he doesn't play well. The discussion then is how well does he have to play for him to stick around? What does not go well mean? And with John Gruden, historically, it's been a pretty high bar, but it's a different era too. So I don't know. I'd love to know what their expectations, their true expectations are for Carr this season. I have an idea of what they think about him. I don't know for sure, but I have an idea of what they probably see in him. I want to know how well he has to play in the minds of Mike Mayock and especially John Gruden in order to stick around.
Do you consider Marcus Mariota a feasible option down the line for the Raiders?
No, not at this point. I think Mariota has a lot to correct, a lot to work on. And the proof is in the pudding last year. Not only was he ineffective in Tennessee, but the offense got very effective once they made the change at QB. Mariota's a respectable talent. There's something to work there, something to work with there. But at this point, there's so much that needs fine-tuning. He doesn't need overhaul, but he needs fine-tune, and he needs his confidence restored. He's not the same confident player that he was as a rookie when I thought he was really intriguing. So there's too many questions right now to say at this point that he might be something down the road.
All right, let's pull the lever again. Up next, we are staying in the Bay Area with Jimmy Garoppolo. Look, big mystery, Andy. He was not as good as we all kind of hoped last year. He was coming off the ACL injury. Just had some. I would call it ball placement issues with and it was sort of all season, and obviously they have an offense that is so heavily based on catch and run type of stuff, and you want to be precise with that ball placement. So I wonder if it gets cleaned up as he gets more confidence in that injured knee and just more confidence overall as he gets more reps as a starter. But is there legitimate reason to worry about him at this point?
I wouldn't say there's legitimate reason to worry. I mean, the guy had a 10-point lead in the fourth quarter of the Super Bowl, so his team has shown you can certainly win with him, and he's won a ton of games as a starter. And his first year in San Francisco, when he's out there before he even really knows the playbook, I think they went 5-0 that year. So there's a lot to like with Garoppolo. He's been very scrutinized, and it's easy to say, well, the system, Kyle Shanahan's system, does a lot of the work. But every quarterback runs their system. So you have to look at the QB within the context of the system. And you could say that Garoppolo and Shanahan's system is probably a top 12, maybe top 10 effective QB. He fits what they do really well. The problem, you touched on it, is he's a little off target at times when he shouldn't be, because he's a talented, quick, compact passer. I don't think it's a glaring problem, though. They still led the league in yards after catch last season. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is, I think he does get robotic at times in the game. I think two or three times every game, he gets caught with a predetermined decision, and it's make or break. Anything can happen there. And there have been times where it's worked out well. I remember George Kittle had a huge touchdown on a Thursday night game against the Raiders a few years ago on a play where Garoppolo was going to kill when the coverage, I think, dictated that the read should have gone somewhere else. And it was a play they'd run earlier, so he was assuming it would work the same way again. But, you know, that worked out really well. There's other times where you've seen him throw interceptions that you wonder what in the heck's going on there. So that needs to get cleaned up a little bit. You don't want 2 to 3 times a game being robotic. That's too many in the league. That's almost 10% of your dropbacks in some games. That, if he can get that corrected, you might live with the little bits of inaccuracy here and there, because he's still able to make some throws that not every QB can make, and their offense, for the most part, has still worked very well with the run after catch.
All right, we will pull the lever and come up with Dak Prescott. Now, he has signed his franchise tender. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're, you know, in a good or a bad place negotiating-wise with a long-term deal. We'll see how that plays out. It would be really interesting. Reportedly, the issue with the contract negotiation, the Cowboys want it to be a very long-term deal, like 5 or 6 years, and Dak only wants to do a couple of years here and take advantage of the seemingly forever rising salary cap that'll keep on paying him more and more. If he goes sort of year to year, if he plays this year on the franchise tag and basically negotiates a long-term deal next offseason, I mean, that's he's probably in for even more money. And look, this is a guy who has not missed a game yet in his NFL career.
Yeah, and Ross Tucker, who does a really nice job, he wrote a few days ago about it. He doesn't understand why Prescott signed the franchise tender, because that got rid of Prescott's leverage. And I thought, you know, I think there's something to that. I thought the arrival of Andy Dalton, though, Gary, was a big deal. We talked about that when they signed Dalton. I thought that really dented Prescott's leverage, because think of it this way. Prescott's a better QB than Dalton, obviously, and Prescott's a quarterback you want to sign long-term if you can. But if you don't sign him, if his asking price is too high, or just whatever it is, you guys don't come to an agreement, and Andy Dalton's on your roster, the alternative is we have Dalton, who's been to the playoffs. I think he went 5 consecutive years in Cincinnati, so you know he's got a pedigree, not a big-time guy, he's a pedigree, and you have probably enough money to go trade for someone like Jamal Adams or sign a big free. You could probably bring in 2 difference makers at the skill positions or on defense and have Dalton. So is that worth it? And I think that's a tough decision. I think that's not everybody's going to have the same answer to that. So unless I'm missing something, I understand why Prescott did sign his tender, because I think Dallas would go to battle with Dalton if they felt they had to. I'm asking. I might be missing something.
No, I don't think so. I mean, look, realistically, I don't think Dak Prescott was going to miss games. I think that's a pretty big statement by your quarterback if he's going to sit out over, you know, a contractual disagreement for a team that has Super Bowl aspirations with the Cowboys, which the Cowboys obviously do. And I think, look, I think for Prescott, I think the thought of playing this year on the franchise tag, because if he does that and has a big year, and you know he's going to pull in 31 point something million dollars this season on that contract, he's in for a monster deal after this year, because they really can't franchise tag him again, but then they're paying him just an exorbitant amount for 2021. So then the starting point for the negotiation is even higher. So it didn't really move me one way or another. I didn't think it was a signal. I think it's a signal that they're probably not super close on a long-term deal. Otherwise, he might have just waited until they had that to announce. But I don't think it really affected his leverage. Like you said, the Dalton thing is interesting, because in the event that, let's say at this point, let's say Dak does suffer some sort of injury that's going to cost him a couple games this year, you know, Andy Dalton running this offense would be, you know, an interesting experiment. You know, can they be good enough? Because obviously, if you can get by with an Andy Dalton or some type like that making very little money, there's no real reason for you to invest the big time dollars in the quarterback, which the Cowboys really haven't done in the past anyway. I mean, they took care of Romo. Well,
yeah, they took care of Romo.
Sorry, I phrased that poorly. They took care of Romo, but they haven't aggressively gone out and, like, seeked out a quarterback. The guys they found have been late-round guys, or they've been, you know, yes. In Romo's case, an undrafted free agent, or they've sort of, you know, kicked the tires and sort of retread types like a Drew Bledsoe or something like that. But post-Troy Aikman, they have not aggressively seeked out a quarterback at this point.
Yeah. No, and Romo fell into their laps to some degree because, as you said, he's an undrafted guy. He didn't fall into their laps, but obviously they did not invest in him up front. Prescott, let's remember, Prescott, like you said, if it goes well this year, he has a lot of leverage next year. Kirk Cousins has made a ton of money by playing the franchise tag game correctly, or he's won the franchise tag game. We've seen that it can be done. Prescott has earned a little under $3 million in NFL money in his four-year career so far. That's over 4 years. Someone's now paying him $31.5 million just for this 1 year. I think there's a human nature thing in play where it's a pandemic, everything's up in the air, you don't know what's going on. I know I'd have a tough time not signing up for $31 million over 1 year, knowing that I've got a chance at even more money next year if I do what I've done already. So I don't think it's crazy at all that Dak Prescott would sign the franchise tag. I don't think it's one bit crazy.
All right.
And by the way, Dalton, his issue is the same as Phillip Rivers over the years, which is that he's not very good. And Rivers' issue last year, Dalton's not very good when the pocket gets messy. And his mechanics really suffer when the pocket gets messy. And sometimes his decision making does as well. When the conditions are well or are nice, he's playing under good circumstances. He can make all the throws, and he sees the field fine. He's a quality player who's dependent on his conditions. Well, the Cowboys have great receivers or great receiving talent, let's say. And as we talked about a second ago, they have a tremendous offensive line still. So there's reason to believe they're going to get – this is the best offensive line Andy Dalton will have ever played behind. They have reason to believe they're going to get a good version of Dalton if he's on the field.
I'm sorry that I didn't give you a chance to get that point out before I pulled the lever again, Andy, but it's already pulled, and I have the name here, and the next quarterback we are talking about is Kirk Cousins. I mean, look, we have to recognize sort of the unintuitive nature of, you know, you have a team that is so reliant on the run and so run heavy, but they have invested so much in their quarterback. And the way this contract is structured, Kirk Cousins is going to be the guy in Minnesota for at least the next 2 years. And, you know, they'll I guess, you know, see what they want to do when he's in his mid-30s and 2022 going forward here. But Kirk Cousins is going to be one of the highest paid quarterbacks in the league, and that's going to be the case in 2020 and 2021. I mean, where are we with him at this point? Does it make sense? When they signed him originally, there seemed to be sort of a shortage of quality quarterbacks, and I understand why they did, but now we are kind of at a place where it seems like, if anything, there are more quality quarterbacks than there are starting jobs available in the NFL, and, you know, they seem to be paying a you know, solid starter, but they're paying him sort of premium money here.
Yeah, and that's back to the classic example of quarterbacks almost always cost what they cost. You don't really get one on a bargain deal if he's a veteran, if he's into the second-year deal. If he's on the first-year contract, you know, that rookie contract, which is great, that rookie wage scale makes him a bargain. That's wonderful. But Cousins, look, the Vikings want somebody who will run the system and minimize mistakes and not turn the ball over. That's what Mike Zimmer wants. And they feel that they have an elite defense still. Therefore, they think their window's open. Give me someone that can manage the offense. That's truly what they want. And Cousins did that last year. His rating as a passer is 107. 26 TDs, 6 interceptions, not a ton of yards, 3,600 yards or so. That's the nature of their offense. So They're going with what they know here, and I was a little surprised they made the deal, because I do think there are some teams who, in Minnesota circumstances, would say we need to start look, not rebuild, but we need to turn the page now, because our defense, yeah, it's the same coaches and some of the same stars, but we've lost a lot of players in the defense this year too. We've got some new guys, and we don't have a lot of cornerbacks for one, and that can really derail a defense in a hurry. So, but that's my interpretation. I don't think every team would say that, and the Vikings obviously didn't feel that way. So I understand why they signed Cousins like they did. It makes a lot of sense. I don't know if I would have or not. It's almost a function, though, of how you feel about the rest of the team than it is how you feel about Cousins. If they had not signed Cousins, what would they have done then? Would you think they would have been in the Tom Brady sweepstakes, which is really just another version of the Cousins decision? It's a win-now QB that you'd be going after. So now we're talking, okay, we're not doing that. Are they drafting someone? Maybe. I mean, maybe they wanted to draft someone. I don't know. They didn't have a high draft pick, though.
So I would have I would have thrown them into the mix as far as, you know, draft a guy, and then you sort of have a developmental guy behind Cousins this year if you're keeping Kirk in town for 2020, which made sense. And part of the reason they did have to make that deal with him was because they were so up against the cap, they needed to move some of that money to later years. I would have, if his deal stood as is, I would have probably invested in one of the quarterbacks in the draft. But we saw the guys who, you know, Dalton signed for very little out in Dallas. You know, obviously you have a Cam Newton still sitting out there. I know there are medical concerns with him, and maybe he's not exactly what you're looking for. But I mean, obviously, you know, you could have him at a pretty reasonable price tag going forward here. I mean, there were guys available out there, a Jameis, you know, a Mariota. There were options for them, and it just seemed a little bit curious that the option they went with was to invest more in Kirk Cousins here.
Yeah, but you know, those QBs you're outlining there, Gary, the Newtons and the Jameis Winstons and Mariotas, you don't know what you're getting with those guys. Those are not take care of the ball type QBs. That's why they are where they are. In part, Newton's a different deal, but Winston obviously has almost intercepted himself out of the NFL, and Mariota's not necessarily a ball security guy either, because if he does play that way, your offense is not getting run to the fullest extent. That's kind of what the Titans found out. So I think Cousins makes sense in that sense. Really, the discussion is, should they have drafted a quarterback? I think that's because if they want a veteran, who would they have signed that would be price friendly, that gives them what they want, which is a guy who they know can run the offense? They don't want, they're paying to not have to be up at night wondering about the QB too. It's a peace of mind thing.
Andy Dalton.
Yeah, you could argue that. I would argue that Cousins is a much better option than Andy Dalton, but then the money comes into the equation and maybe that changes. Are there others?
No.
Yeah.
I mean, Teddy Bridgewater's a guy they you know, he ended up getting paid, so it's not quite the same thing here, but no, other than that, no.
So what we're really discussing is it's between Dalton and Cousins, which we could do a whole podcast on if we wanted, but we've talked about both already here. Or it's, should they have drafted a QB? And the only guy left on the board when the Vikings were picking at 22 is Jordan Love. So, which is obviously not a ready to win now known entity. At least that's not what he was drafted to be in Green Bay. So I'm not sure what other choices they had, given that they view themselves as a contender. If they were really hitting the restart button, then maybe you should take a Jordan Love or whatever you want to do. But that's not the way they're going about things right now.
All right. We have one quarterback left. If you guys read the description of the episode, you'll know who it is. But for the rest of you, we'll pull the lever. And it is Teddy Bridgewater. So look, we don't know exactly what this Panthers offense is going to look like under Joe Brady. Brady obviously had Bridgewater for a season, 2018 in New Orleans. So some familiarity there. I guess what's kind of interesting, we saw a more aggressive Bridgewater last year when he started those five games while Drew Brees was out. It's still just looking at this Panthers offense. I mean, you know, they signed Robbie Anderson. They had Curtis Samuel. They had DJ Moore, who's sort of a breakout guy. It seems like they're kind of built still like Cam Newton is their quarterback, and they still want to throw it downfield. That's still, regardless of what Bridgewater did in 2019, I don't really know that really fits for him.
No, he's not at all. You're not going to be a run-first offense with Teddy Bridgewater as part of the running game, which is what Newton's value was. Now, you might be a run-first offense with the QB not part of the running game, but that's a whole different style of running offense to what Carolina has been before. We're talking different blocking schemes, different formations, different run designs. So they know that Christian McCaffrey is their best player and everything runs through him. I think they want to be, I would imagine there's going to be a lot of pre-snap emphasis in Carolina, a lot of motioning, a lot of shifting, a lot of different formations like what the Saints have done. They have wide receivers who are kind of all similar to each other. Robbie Anderson, they signed DJ Moore, Curtis Samuel, who it's a big year for Samuel, but there's some intriguing stuff there. Those are their wideouts. Those three guys, I imagine, can all align just about anywhere. Anderson, I don't know if he could be a slot guy at times for them, but they're going to be fairly interchangeable at wide receiver, I think. So I imagine they'll play a highly schemed style of football. And Matt Rhule recently said they made comment about run after catch emphasis on the offense, a dink and dunk offense, if you will, in a good way, which is really what the Saints asked of Bridgewater last year. Bridgewater made some throws. He had a handful of big time throws when the situation demanded it, third down and long. I remember one, he was backed up against the Buccaneers. It was a game in New Orleans. And he had one of the best third down outside the number throws I saw all season, which I never thought he was able to make that throw. So yeah, he's gotten better as a passer in that sense, but that's still not his innate nature. And I've never played quarterback or even been around pro QBs on a day-to-day basis, but I would imagine it feels a little different making those aggressive, deep, difficult throws when you're the starter versus when you're the guy who's filling in for the starter who you know is going to be back on the field as soon as he's healthy. It's a part-time gig in New Orleans that Bridgewater had. So maybe he plays a little differently there. I think you run a dink and dunk offense with Bridgewater, manage the game very well, play to your defense. The stuff we're talking about, and that's probably kind of, and this is probably how we get to QBs who are on the cusp or on the fringe. What do we make of them? They all kind of seem to run an offense almost similar to that, don't they, Gary?
Yeah, a little bit. I guess I'm just curious. The Robbie Anderson thing just stands out to me for the Panthers. They got him on a good deal. They got him at good value, so I don't blame them for bringing him in. It was just, I don't know.
Well, you need somebody to play. You need to play. You do. You need to have guys.
You do. I thought Anderson was such a good fit in New York with the Jets, and they should have just ponied up and kept them. And now he's in Carolina, where the quarterback just doesn't really fit his skill set.
Probably fair. Yeah, because Anderson's skill set is go routes, fade routes, deep comebackers, and one cut routes. So post patterns, the occasional corner route, depending on where he lines up. He's going to line up outside most of the time, so it's really depending on the formation. Those are his routes. That's kind of what he is. And as we're talking it through, you know, slant routes, option routes, short intermediate stuff, you know, that's not what we're describing with Anderson. So you could argue that he doesn't perfectly fit what they want to do. I do understand there's something to be said for you're Matt Rhule, you're Joe Brady, you're putting in a new system. You need to have some guys that you know are professional football players who are going to understand what you tell them and execute it correctly, whether it fits their skill set ideally or not. You need to have some, to me, that's what leadership really is guys that can do it correctly and can make your meeting rooms better because they're professional athletes. I think they viewed Anderson in that light as we just need a quality receiver right now. We can't afford to worry about perfect fits because we're rebuilding over the course of several years anyway.
All right. Fair enough. Our lever is all out of whatever this mechanism was that we put together. It's out of names. So that means it's the end of the show, Andy. But
all right.
Once again, thank you for joining us. And we'll call this just goodbye for now.
All right. Thanks, Gary.
The MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast is me, Gary Gramling. Special thanks to Andy Benoit for joining me once again. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of a podcast is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Mravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB. Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL Podcast. Keep up with our entire lineup of podcasts 5 days a week by subscribing to the MMQB NFL Podcast for free on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please do us a favor and leave a rating and review. It really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, Radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.